News, I'm David Byrd in Washington. California law enforcement officials are trying to learn why a 28-year-old former U.S. Marine went into a country nightclub Wednesday and shot and killed 12 people. AP's Ed Donahue reports.
Paul Delacorte with the FBI says the crime scene and gunman Ian Long's home and car are being processed for evidence.
At this point, we do not have any indicators of other associates or there are no other threats to the Los Angeles area.
Delacorte says it's too early to talk about a motive. California Governor-elect Gavin Newsom blamed the country's gun culture.
Suffice it to say, the response is not just prayers. The response cannot just be excuses. The response sure as hell cannot be more guns.
Newsom says mass shootings do not happen anywhere else on planet Earth. I'm Ed Donahue.
The United States has announced additional sanctions against a number of Russian and Ukrainian entities tied to Russia's actions in Ukraine. The U.S. Treasury Department said the sanctions affect two people and one group engaged in serious human rights abuses in parts of Ukraine. The effect of the sanctions is to freeze any U.S. assets held by the individuals or entities and to prohibit U.S. citizens from doing business with them. The Trump administration took a major step on Thursday to restrict asylum claims by migrants, putting forward a regulation that would make individuals ineligible for asylum if they crossed the U.S. southern border illegally. Migrants entering at the southern border would only be eligible for asylum if they come to official ports of entry. The American Civil Liberties Union immediately rejected the move. A spokesman said that U.S. law specifically allows individuals to apply for asylum whether or not they are at a port of entry. This is VOA News. Protesters are gathered in cities from New York to California in a warning to the White House not to derail Robert Mueller's probe into Russian meddling in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. Progressive groups hastily organized the marches after President Donald Trump fired Attorney General Jeff Sessions Wednesday and named Matt Whitaker as his acting replacement. Whitaker will be overseeing the Mueller investigation, but has made it known that he is hostile to the probe into whether the Trump campaign colluded with the Russians and if the president obstructed justice. The crowd in New York City's Times Square chanted "hands off Mueller" and waved various anti-Trump signs. A federal appeals court is weighing a case that challenges the constitutionality of special counsel Robert Mueller to lead the Russia investigation. We get details from AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
The challenge to Robert Mueller's authority comes from Andrew Miller, who has defied a subpoena to testify before a grand jury about his former boss, Roger Stone. Stone, a longtime associate of President Trump, is under investigation for his connection to WikiLeaks, which published damaging emails stolen from the Clinton campaign in 2016. Stone's former aide, Miller, is claiming the deputy attorney general did not have the authority to appoint a special counsel. That claim is now in the hands of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
A federal appeals court has blocked President Donald Trump's efforts to end the program that shields hundreds of thousands of young immigrants from deportation. The three-judge panel in San Francisco ruled Thursday that the plaintiffs were likely to succeed in challenging the Trump administration's decision to phase out the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. The court said that Trump's decision was arbitrary, capricious, or otherwise not in accordance with law. Two lower courts had also blocked Trump's move. North Korean officials postponed a meeting with U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo that had been scheduled for this week because they were not ready. That's according to Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was due to meet with Kim Jong-chul, a senior advisor to North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. They were going to discuss moving forward on a vague agreement signed in June by Kim and U.S. President Donald Trump during their summit. Haley, who talked to reporters before and after a closed-door meeting of the U.N. Security Council, played down the delay, saying, "I don't think there was some major issue for the postponement." For more on these stories, be sure to visit our website, voanews.com. I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, November 9th, and here are some of the stories we're covering. Cameroon jails a journalist on charges of reporting false information about the separatist unrest.
Mimi Mefo's lawyer says that at around midnight Wednesday, her client was taken to a prison called New Bell after they showed up as requested at a gendarmerie station in Cameroon's economic capital, Douala.
That's correspondent Moki Edwin Kinzeka in Yaoundé. The number of refugees in Uganda has been revised. Gabon's President Ali Bongo is still not back in Gabon, more than 2 weeks after it had been announced that he had fallen ill in Saudi Arabia. And Malawi's president has been criticized for not including his Mbatu vice president in his new 20-member cabinet.
Malawi is governed by rule of law, not by rule of man. So this is the kind of crisis that we are facing, where the president is trying to personally hijack what the constitution says.
Vincent Kondwe is a member of the Political Science Association of Malawi, and the South Sudan government reverses its ban on vehicles with tinted windows. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A popular journalist from Cameroon's restive English-speaking region remains in jail after she was arrested and charged with propagating false information and terrorism. Media rights groups say the arrest of Equinox broadcast journalist Mimi Mefo is an attempt to silence outlets that report on the crisis. As Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports, Mefo's arrest comes as authorities scout the region for two school staff members still missing after they and at least 79 students were abducted earlier this week.
Mimi Mefo's lawyer, Alice Nkon, says that at around midnight Wednesday, her client was taken to a prison called New Bell some 10 hours after they showed up as requested at a gendarmerie station in Cameroon's economic capital, Douala.
Mimi a usé de son droit de garder silence.
Nkon says Mefo had opted for the right to remain silent after gendarmerie officials accused Mefo of reporting false information. Nkon says the gendarmerie were referring to a report in which Mefo said bullets found in bodies of civilians killed in violence came from the regular army, not armed separatists, as the military had alleged. Nkon says the gendarmes also presented screenshots of Mefo's Facebook pages and accused her client of cyber crimes, saying that most of what was published constituted an attack on state security. Libom Lilikeng, Cameroon's telecommunications minister, says the law provides for several sanctions, including prison sentences of up to 2 years for people guilty of using social media to propagate false information. She says the propagation of such information on social media is punished with a sentence of 6 months to 2 years in prison and a fine ranging from $8,000 to $16,000. Other journalists who have been detained for several weeks in Cameroon include Michelle Biem Tong, known for being highly critical of executions he alleges are committed by the military fighting the Boko Haram insurgency and crisis in the English-speaking regions. He was arrested on October 23. Gustave Robert Kenyi, publisher of Orientation Hebdo that specializes in reporting human rights abuses, was arrested in the western town of Bafoussam on October 29, just after Joseph Olinga of Le Jour newspaper was arrested. The arrests have been described by hundreds of journalists as part of the government's crackdown, especially on those who follow the conflict in the Anglophone region. The governor of the northwest region of Cameroon, Deben Chofo, says he has called on the administration and soldiers to look for the remaining staff, but he is counting on the collaboration of the population. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Malawian President author Peter Mutharika has failed to include his embattled Vice President Solus Chilima in his new 20-member cabinet. Civil society and opposition groups have criticized the omission. Traditionally, the Vice President is a prominent member of the cabinet, but Vice President Chilima recently fell out with President Mutharika after accusing the president of rampant corruption. The vice president has since resigned from the ruling Democratic Progressive Party and plans to challenge the president in next year's general election. Vincent Kondwe is a member of the Political Science Association of Malawi.
The Constitution of the Republic of Malawi provides that a concurrently elected vice president automatically becomes a member of the cabinet. But here we have a situation where the president of the country, who saw to defend and protect the Malawi Constitution, has, through political expedience, opted not to include an elected office of the vice presidency in his cabinet. That is a constitutional crisis. So the people are reacting to say the president has become a kind of a laughing stock, a law professor who cannot be able to defend the constitution that he sought to defend.
Every Tom, Dick and Harry in cabinet serve at the pleasure of the president. His supporters are saying the president is just respecting the dictates of the constitution, which empowers him to hire and fire. So what is the problem here, they ask?
At the pleasure of the president within the framework of the constitution, not within the framework of his mind. Malawi is governed by rule of law, not by rule of man. So this is the kind of the crisis that we are facing, where the president is trying to personally hijack what the constitution says and through political expediency try to bring in issues that are undermining the integrity of the Republican constitution.
But Vincent, some are saying that he need not explain himself to the people because the people voted for him to administer the affairs of the state. So if during the course of his work and he decides to bring new people to help him to achieve his vision, what is the problem with that?
The cardinal provision of the Malawi Constitution is that the president and his vice are elected concurrently. The mandate of the vice president does not come from the president. It comes from the people of Malawi. The president has got no say in deciding whether the vice president serves his cabinet or not. It's the people of Malawi, through their universal suffrage, that decide who becomes the vice president. So the president, through his own volition, does not have the mandate to fire the vice president from being a member of the cabinet. Full stop. It's non-negotiable and it's an intrinsic provision of the Malawi Constitution.
But some are saying the vice president has demonstrated gross insubordination and disrespect to the president. Why should he complain, or why should his supporters complain that he's been sidelined when he is accusing the same government he is part of endemic corruption?
I agree. There's collective responsibility in saving the cabinet of the Republic of Malawi. But at the same time, we must understand that the vice president plays a delegated role. And whatever the vice president advises the president, it's at the discretion of the president to take the advice that is coming from the vice president.
Vincent Kondwe is a member of the Political Science Association of Malawi. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty from Karunga in northern Malawi. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte, Washington. Today's Friday, November 9th. Daybreak Africa time is now 14 minutes past the hour. The Ugandan government and UN agencies yesterday, Thursday, announced results of a refugee verification exercise. Hilary Onek, Minister in charge of refugees, says the verification found that there are 10 million refugees as opposed to over 1.4 million refugees in the country. Joe Butro, the UNHCR representative in the country, says the verification will help UN agencies and the government to easily provide much needed services to the refugees. Mugumi Davis Rakenridge reports from Kampala.
Minister Hilary Onek says the government and UN agencies used advanced means, including biometric registration, to ensure the figures are accurate.
Using the new technology, which is more precise, the number so far registered was 1,092,213 individuals, which constitutes about 76% of the previously recorded number of 1.4 million.
This means that the number of refugees registered is less by about 24%, or about 350,000 individuals. Minister Onek attributed this to some refugees having returned to their countries of origins, those that died, and double registration. Onek also says that about 1,500 Ugandans registered as refugees in order to benefit from the aid provided to actual refugees. With over a million refugees, Uganda remains the highest refugee-hosting country in Africa and the third top refugee-hosting nation in the world. Minister Onek says the government will continue registering the new arrivals and those that were not registered during the verification exercise.
The government has provided a grace period of 2 months within which any registered refugee and asylum seeker who missed the exercise, this recent registration exercise, can approach Office of the Prime Minister for verification. Taking this into consideration, the above verification numbers are preliminary. A more detailed analysis will be undertaken after the grace period.
There have been more than 6,200 new arrivals registered since March this year, according to the UN Refugee Agency. The majority of the new arrivals are from the Democratic Republic of Congo and South Sudan. Joy Botoy, the UNHCR country representative in Uganda, says the verification of refugees will help both the government and the UN agencies to easily assist those in need.
The new system allows us better tracing and tracking of people with special needs, of unaccompanied minors, and other people who may have very special needs. This new system will enable all of us, starting with OPM and UNHCR, and our partners to be more efficient in their delivering the assistance, including, obviously, in the delivering of food assistance by the World Food Programme.
Most of the refugees in Uganda are from South Sudan, DR Congo, Burundi, Somalia, Ethiopia, and Eritrea. Uganda has been praised as having one of the most progressive refugee policies in the world. But officials here say refugee and host community projects are inadequately funded by the donors. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Gabonese President Ali Bongo is still not back in Gabon more than 2 weeks after it was first announced he had been hospitalized in Saudi Arabia. The only information the government provided to its citizens was that Bongo had been diagnosed with severe fatigue. Paul Marie Gonju is Deputy Executive Secretary of main opposition leader Jean Ping's National Union Party. He says this lack of transparency by the government has led to speculation on the social media about the president's health.
At this time, we don't know exactly what is going on. The only news we got coming from French newspaper or press agencies like Reuters. We only know that from that paper that he's suffering a stroke and had surgery. Those news are not being confirmed by the government. This is not an official medical statement. It's coming from quite agencies and French newspaper, but the government also did not deny all those information. So we think that if they don't deny those information, it means that there is a kind of truth behind.
So, Paul, in these days of social media, I'm sure there is a lot of information on the social media in Gabon. What are people saying on the social media there?
Well, the people are just taking all the news coming from papers and trying to investigate the government. There are so many things going on the social media that people saying everything, good and bad things and rumors. I mean, I don't know how can I express that. Everybody is saying everything.
So the government does not give the country daily briefings about the president's health? No briefings?
No daily briefing, even weekly briefing, nothing of this. We heard that there was a meeting in the presidential palace 2 days ago and that the ministers had been informed of the situation, but not the population.
The president being out of the country for so long, this leads to speculations, as you said. How much impact is this having on, say, business in Gabon or the economy as a whole?
It's only been, what, 15 days that is not in the country, but the time would be about the constitution, the laws that the president is out to sign. It would be a time when the government would need the president's signature. It's not going to be long because there is a family law coming from the parliament that should be signed by the president. Also, the budget law that the president has to sign. So it's not going to be long that the country would be in kind of blockade. I think that if that situation is lasting more than a month, it's going to be very, very difficult for the country.
In case the president is incapable or incapacitated in doing his job, what does the Constitution say in terms of succession?
In case of vacancy, the Constitution is very clear that the head of the Senate will be sworn as acting president, and his main task would be to prepare and organize the new presidential election, which should be held in 2 months after the vacancy has been declared.
Paul Marie Gonjou is the Deputy Executive Secretary of main opposition leader Jean Ping's National Union Party. He was speaking with me from the Gabonese capital, Libreville. The South Sudan government has reversed an earlier order banning vehicles with tinted windows. The government has announced that such vehicles are no longer illegal on public roads after a public outcry from drivers whose vehicles were impounded. Winnie Chirino has the story from Juba.
One boda boda operator stationed in Juba's High Mauna neighborhood, who spoke on condition of anonymity for fear of reprisal from authorities, accuses traffic police of extorting money from boda boda drivers even when they have obtained all the necessary documents to operate their motorcycle.
If they tell you pay 2,000, you pay. If they tell you pay how much money, you pay. If you don't pay, they took there your motorcycle. And when they took there, even if you have everything, logbook, everything, they don't release you, your motorbike just like that. They will still charge you on this.
Another cyclist stationed in Juba's Kololo neighborhood who declined to be identified for fear of reprisals says the traffic police often bar boda boda drivers from using a main street from Juba's Buluk area to Muduria, commonly known as Jowan Road. He says the traffic police always force cyclists to take longer routes, forcing them to increase their fees.
Any police or an army man can decide to arrest a motorbike just within the area, even on the road, not even a traffic police. They just arrest people, like they call for money. Of course, somebody will pay the money because for the sake of his motorbike.
Speaking in Arabic, another motorcycle taxi operator stationed in Tongping residential area accuses the Juba City Council Boda Boda Association of collecting 500 South Sudanese pounds for monthly subscription, and yet the association does nothing to support cyclists when after they have submitted complaints of theft, attacks and harassments by police soldiers.
They are
supposed to help us when we have problems. I am among the few people whose motorbike was stolen and I was attacked. My motorbike was taken and I went to the office to report, and I gave them their registration form together with a photocopy of my logbook. They told me they will see a way forward to look for it. My paper has been there almost 1 month. There is nothing.
Major General Daniel Justin, spokesperson of the South Sudan National Police Service, says motorcyclists and other drivers must obey all road regulations and advises drivers to request a receipt if fined.
There are violations which we consider as minor violations. This is where we advise the driver, we advise the owner of the car, we advise the rider that please don't repeat this and so on. So these slight violations, sometimes even if you are charged with fine, it will be very little amount, 100, 200 and so on.
Army spokesman Major General Lul Rai Kwang denies soldiers take money from boda boda drivers.
First time I'm hearing, because our servicemen have not been dealing with boda bodas. I've been seeing police loading on the motorbike. I never came across South Sudan people, the transport getting involved in that.
South Sudan in Focus reached out to a number of traffic police officers. All of them declined to comment. Abraham Jok, chairperson of the South Sudan Border Board Association, did not respond to repeated requests to be interviewed for this story. For VOA News, I am Winnie Sereno in Juba.
Minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin with the finals of the CAF Champions League. Following their home 3-1 victory last weekend, Egyptian giant Al Ahly are in Tunis as they take on host Esperance in the decisive return leg of the 2018 Total CAF Champions League final. The 60,000 Olympic Stadium at Raids will be the venue when the North African rivals lock horns yet again later tonight. Some sports journalists who spoke with VOA Daybreak Africa Sports have favoured Al Ahly to win the title.
Al Ahly of Egypt certainly were the favourites going into the competition, seeking a night title. So going into the second leg in Rades, Tunis, you get the feeling that the old sway, and the last time they travelled to play Esperance in Tunis, they won there by goals north and two. So it seems like it's done and dusted for Al Ahly to win their night CAF Champions League title.
Esperance themselves, you can't take away anything. You can't take anything away from them. They've done well. It's not easy to get to the final of a continental club competition. I just want to see that magic that will be performed by Esperance to win this trophy.
We hope that on Friday, when the finals, the second leg will be played, it will be a very beautiful game to watch, and let's see who goes on with the cup. But the way it stands now, it appears Al Ahly have won the Champions League for the ninth time.
In women's football news, Equatorial Guinea have won their appeal to CAF to have their place among the 8 team playing at the 11th Women African Cup of Nations in Ghana upheld. The decision means Kenya's Harambee Starlets will after all not feature in the AFCON finals scheduled for Ghana after the Confederation of African Football turned the tables again. The African body have now stripped off Kenya the right to participate in the competition and instead reinstated Equatorial Guinea, who had been struck off for allegedly fielding an ineligible player. The latest development comes just a day after the Kenyan Federation threatened to pull out the Starlets from the tournament owing to lack of funds. In the meantime, Harambee Starlet drew 1-1 with Ghana at the Kasarani Stadium in a warm-up match ahead of the African Women's Cup of Nations scheduled for Ghana. Coach Bashir Hayford, head coach of the Black Queens of Ghana, confirmed that the team will play more friendly games before the tournament begins.
This is a good match for us to go back to Ghana and play South Africa. We are going to play South Africa on Sunday. So immediately we reach on Friday, we have to prepare for Sunday to play against South Africa. And that probably is going to be our last match.
And on to athletics news. Four-time New York City Marathon champion Mary Kitiani is back in Kenya, but to a rather quiet reception after her latest victory in the United States. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. And that is it for this Friday, November 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Carl Starling, I'm James Botti in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good weekend.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
What's up, Africa? I'm Jackson Bungani in Washington.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We love to have you on board. This is Upfront on The Voice of America.
Listen, we need to discuss what's going on in your communities, issues that affect you.
Are you involved?
Are you engaged in transforming your society?
Today, right now, this is your platform.
Let us know what you've been up to.
Check us out on Facebook. Drop us a line.
It's Upfront Wednesdays at 1730 UTC
right here on VOA Africa.